Well, hello to all of you out there. Welcome to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on a rather dreary Monday, but better than we have had, as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. Well, the shows continue. The new year hasn't disappointed a bit. All the new shows coming at us now in January. More will be coming in February. More in March as the theater season gets underway for 2018, and it will prove to be a very interesting theatrical season as well. First off, we're going to journey over and talk to our friends at the Kansas City Repertory Theater, where they are presenting the play, The Curious Case of the Dog in the Nighttime. Sounds very mysterious. Perhaps not as mysterious as the title would lead you to believe, but a very interesting show. Nonetheless, two of the performers are with us. Andy Perkins is with us. He plays voice number 3, which actually consists of several characters, mm-hmm. from what he told me. He is a local actor, has been involved with improv, did The Diary of Anne Frank at the Rep, also appeared in The Christmas Carol, the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival, the Coterie Theater, and probably many more along with that as well. Welcome, Andy, to the program. Nicole Marie Green is voice number 1. It's always nice to be number 1.
It's always nice to be number 1.
She also appeared in The Diary of Anne Frank and The Christmas Carol, so they probably know each other. Also, Our Town... The version of Our Town that had that unique staging.
Yes, it was David Cromer's production of Our Town.
And they actually brought him in to help.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
That. Yeah. We might talk about, if we have time, later on in the broadcast, the Coterie Theater. She has appeared. The Unicorn in Tribes, if you remember that interview. The Heart of America Shakespeare Festival as well. You've both been in quite a few things together as well.
We also are a couple. Oh.
Well, I don't know if I would recommend that.
We would.
I think working career should be separate, but that's a whole other discussion.
That's for the relationship show.
It's over. Sorry.
She has. She was one of the. We've talked about it in previous interviews. The MFA Performing Arts Program at UMKC, very prestigious. She is a graduate of that. And so she originally came from New York and was able to get through that screening process to be one of very few that they select every year. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Was that valuable to you?
Oh, hugely. Also, I don't think I would have come to Kansas City if it weren't for that program. And then I fell in love with the city enough that I've stayed. So I call Kansas City home now.
Yeah. She didn't just come for Westport, folks.
It's true.
Welcome both of you
Thank
to the
you.
Show. The Curious Case of the Dog in the Nighttime. Sounds very mysterious, and there is a mystery involved in it, of course, but some of the side issues are autism, mm-hmm. and other things as well. So tell us about, whichever one of you would like to, the basic storyline of The Curious Case of the Dog.
Yeah, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And what happens is we open on Christopher, who is a young boy in Swindon in England, and he discovers this dog has been murdered in the middle of the night. He is at first suspected of having committed this crime, but then he makes it his mission to try and solve this mystery of who could have done it. And so he's going around asking his neighbors, trying to solve this crime. His dad keeps telling him to stay out of other people's business. And through the solving of this mystery, he ends up discovering some interesting things about his history, his family, that kind of leads us to furthering the plot of the story as well. And I won't give anything
No spoilers,
away about,
please.
Yeah, no spoilers about that. But it's a very engaging and very interesting, multifaceted story.
Yeah. So tell us about the – you play several voices in the show. You're voice number 3,
voice
but you have
three.
More than 3 characters.
Yes, that's correct. I believe I have at least 5 characters, but then there's a couple other times when we're all just kind of saying lines, popping in and out, doing some voiceovers as well that have been recorded earlier and kind of create a sound tapestry at moments where a lot of voices are happening at the same time, because the entire play is seen through Christopher's experience, through Christopher's lens, and he is an individual with autism, and so there are moments that are very overwhelming to him, that there's so much stimuli, that
kind of a sensory overload.
Yeah, exactly. And so we represent that on stage through movement, through sound, mm-hmm. through lighting, through the set itself, to help tell that part of the story as well, and allow the audience kind of an entryway into that experience.
I think the audience needs to know and would like to know this unique staging that you're doing. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, essentially, Nicole, like when you do come to the show, the set itself is like an art piece. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're walking into the Block Museum. I mean, it's entirely white. So that gives us a lot of room to kind of create lighting aspects, to become things. So there's six voices. There's a cast of 10. And the voices play multiple characters, but we also become waves at one point. So we're physically becoming waves. We become turnstiles in the middle of London.
Yeah, he's going through his house looking for things. Yes. We represent those different
those little
rooms
things in his pockets.
Yeah.
And so we are constantly on stage as an ensemble, whether it be kind of Greek chorus style supporting him or becoming Christopher's imagination or kind of the voices in his head. But I would call it a memory play because it's kind of, it flashes back, it flashes forward. I play a character, a principal who just pops up and he remembers her saying one-liners and then she'll pop away. So it's a lot of, design elements that are played with, like our costumes pieces are not full costumes. We're not often doing full costume changes. It'll just be one piece that changes who we are. And vocally, it is a British show. So we're using British dialects, and then we're based in Swindon, which is a kind of a lower status. We have a bit of Cockney in there. So when you're playing five or six different characters, you have to really differentiate your physicality, but also vocally, how to change people so everyone's not like, oh, who's that character?
Yeah,
who's that?
Scott Stackhouse was our dialect coach, and he came in throughout the course of the process to work with us and finding those subtle variations to kind of make sure that each character was specifically unique and that they weren't all just sounding generally British.
Yeah, which is tough. Yeah. But I mean, it's really a visually stunning piece. Mm-hmm. Like, it's amazing to watch because Christopher is so involved and picked up on so many things outside of himself. Like, he's very, very astute to picking small details up. Mm-hmm. We kind of invite the audience in to be able to see that, and all these bodies kind of create those little details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Central Standard Theater comes on the program, they come at least once, sometimes twice a year, performers from Great Britain.
Yeah.
They come on and they do shows. Usually it's at the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater, and the subject often of dialects comes up.
Yeah.
Because they, even though they're both, I shouldn't say both, even though many of them are from the same area of England, they sound oftentimes completely different. Mm-hmm. So I broached the subject, of course, and they said to me, from town to town, the dialect changes a little bit.
Yeah.
So it could be anything. So you're playing several voices. Mm-hmm. Is your challenge to do each one just a slightly different, or are you easier on yourself?
It's part of the challenge, for sure. It's helpful to have Scott there, and he's had private meetings with each of us individually during the rehearsal process to kind of talk through, okay, what do we want to do with this character? Whether it's a vowel shift or whether it's dropping a consonant here or dropping the T's here, and making sure that it's not just for the sake of doing it, but also motivated by where we feel this character is coming from and the function that they serve in the play. So for one of my, I play a couple police officers. I play a police officer in Swindon, and I play a police officer in London. And the police officer in Swindon is a bit gruffer, a bit more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then the police officer in London is a bit more calm and measured and approaches the situation with a bit more thought. And so we're able to reflect those points of view in the dialect work as well. So that's one of the things that I really appreciated discovering with Scott through the dialect.
Yeah, he was great. He was really like, we need to, the whole point is to tell the story. So we don't want it to be a dialect play.
Right.
But if you do your work in the very beginning, then it doesn't become a dialect play because you're not thinking about it anymore.
Yeah, it just becomes part another part of the character.
Yeah, another element.
So not only are you different characters, you're different characters with different dialects.
Right. Yeah.
So this adds to the difficulties of things. Usually doing a Reader's Theater style project is usually a lot of fun for people. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're put to a lot of work, though.
I mean, it's the best kind of theater in my... It's my favorite part to do because you get to be so many different people. I mean, you get to transform. Mm-hmm. And even if it's a person who has three lines, it doesn't matter because it's important to the story. And because we have the best ensemble, we have like a team of really wonderful actors who are so gung-ho about trying anything. We would start our rehearsal days like rolling on the floor and humming and like, you know, like doing all sorts of crazy things. And not once was anyone cynical of it. Like everyone's like, let's do it. Let's get into this. Like, mm-hmm. let's figure out what this is. So like some days we would become a train and we'd just take 15 minutes and like vocally make sounds and physically create it until we came up with kind of a picture that Marissa Wolf is our director and she's also brilliant. She's super collaborative. So a lot of the pictures that are on stage really came from the ensemble creating them.
So we have a lady from San Francisco.
Yeah.
Directing a lady from New York and a gentleman from around here with British dialects.
It's true.
So very interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah.
The name of the
Global
show is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It runs at the Missouri Repertory Theater, opens January 26th and runs through February 18th at the Spencer Theater. That's the one on the campus of UMKC. The number to call for more information, 816-235-2700. And arrangements and questions can be answered also online at kcrep.org. We're speaking with Andy Perkins, voice number 3, and Nicole Marie Green, voice number 1. Two of the key voices in the show, of course. You mentioned other performers in the show. Let's name them if we can.
You got it. Well, we've got Bree Elrod. She's playing the main teacher. We also have Jamie Sanders, who is our only out-of-towner. He's from New York. Jason Chanos, Stephanie Roberts, Rufus Burns, Walter Coppedge, Chioma Aniawu, and Andy Perkins, obviously, and myself, and Peggy Friesen, which we've seen a lot. But they're incredible. I mean, especially the combo of everyone, it's really tremendous.
Yeah, and a lot of, I mean, like you were saying, you know, there's a lot of ensemble parts to it all. And so we really have had to work collaboratively together throughout the rehearsal process. And everyone has just, it's been a wonderful experience to dive in and create some of these moments together, which can be a little bit intricate and a little bit complicated, which can be taxing. But with this group, it's been
so positive.
Yeah, exactly.
So much fun. I don't want it to stop.
In a show like this, working together is very important.
You have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to be down for anything. And I mean, we're like jumping on each other's backs and creating all these funny pictures and just helping each other out. I mean, there's a lot of support here of just ideas thrown out and people willing to try them. And
yeah, and I think that that's something that Marissa, the director, established early on was that this was going to be a collaborative experience. She said that, I think, the first day of rehearsal.
I mean, she cultivates one of the most positive theater rooms I've ever been in. Marissa is she's casual, but she takes ownership of a room. She really is, I mean, her energy is definitely splattered all over that stage. You can see it because she just brings people together and she allows creativity to just blossom. Whereas, you know, there's lots of different experiences you have, but there's by the books, and Marissa does a really good job of kind of doing it her own way, the way that works for her.
Yeah. Interesting dichotomy of things, the way they work together.
Yeah.
Things have to fit very well, and people have to work well together as well. You've probably all been in shows where the working together part wasn't as good, perhaps.
It happens
as this.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
It happens
it's our sometimes. Job to make it work, but
yeah.
Well, that's a good way to put it.
It's true.
Nicole, you have to. It's your job to make it work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what was called sensitive interpretive performing. Now, that's what you're doing here,
mm-hmm.
and the audience, as well as myself, frankly, said, "What do they mean by that?" Well, what do you mean?
There is a special performance that's sensory friendly, and it's February 13th,
yep.
Which is a Tuesday. And essentially, it's going to be a performance for anyone, but specifically for individuals that might be overwhelmed by too much stimuli. And so what's going to happen is the sound is going to be quieter, turned down just a little bit. The house lights, the house of the theater lights will actually be up. People will be welcome to stand up, walk around, and speak during the show if they feel the need to. We'll have a quiet space out in the lobby. And also, actually, before the show begins and during intermission, there's what's known as a social story led by Jen Greenstreet. And that's where people can go and actually get a breakdown of what the story is and make sure they understand the flow of the story before heading into to the theater, so they kind of have an understanding of that.
And that's going to be available throughout the that whole show on February 13th. So it's almost like a PowerPoint, and it's outside, so you can go early to the show and be able to view that, but also if you want to go during intermission or even step out. It's just a sensory-friendly show. So I've actually never done a production like that, but I think it's incredibly important. And because Christopher Boone, our main character, is an individual with autism, I know the rep thought it was important to make it an inclusive piece. Mm-hmm. So we have that kind of special evening. But it's also, I mean, throughout the run, we hope that everyone will be able to come and see it. I mean, it's a beautiful show. It won the Tony Award for Best Play in 2015. Mm-hmm. And it's actually based off of a book that I think many people have read.
Yeah,
same title, mm-hmm. by Mark Haddon. And then Simon Stevens adapted it into a play. We actually saw it in New York.
Yeah, we did.
And it was mind-blowing. I mean, we both sat there and there's not a ton of plays. We see tons of theater, but I was like, that is a play that I have to do in my lifetime. Like, I didn't know it would be within the next, like, 2 years.
Yeah, kind of lucked out here.
I mean, I was, like, melting all over. I told everyone about it. I was like, this is genius. This is why theater exists. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And because it can touch everyone in some way, it's not about the autism. It's just through one individual's perspective. And I think that's important to know about any play.
Well, that's important to know specifically as well, because, you know, there is an autism spectrum. And so there are many different experiences that live within that. And so this one particular experience happens to be Christopher,
right,
the character's experience. And so we're helping tell that story through his lens, through his eyes. But there's so many different facets to the play. There's humor, there's intrigue, there's mystery. So it's got it all.
Is the lead traditionally played by an autistic individual?
You know, on Broadway, it wasn't. I think, and
most
I could be wrong, yes, Indiana had
Indiana
an actor who was an autistic, an actor with autism, and I know that was important to Marissa to reach out and really look for that. And she ended up meeting Jamie in New York. He auditioned there. And he is incredible. He actually has Tourette's, which is not the same as autism. Mm-hmm. However, he is incredibly open. And he said it's a great way in, because he also, like as a younger child, had episodes or outbursts that he can relate to Christopher's story. But working with him is like working with any other actor. I mean, he's young and vibrant.
Well,
and
he came in so prepared too, like for day one. I mean, he has a lot of text, but he came in. In fact, I believe he had more than enough.
He was over prepared.
Yeah, he actually had there's a British version of the script and an American version of the script, and he had the British version of the script, and he had over-memorized.
He's like, wait a second, why does it say cookies in this American script and it says biscuits in the British script? But it actually is much more than that. There's like extra monologues and things like
that. Added text. But it was actually good as well, because he had that extra insight.
It's almost like he had dramaturgically helped himself and us. Mm-hmm. Because he's like, oh, actually, there's several other lines that help this line.
Mm-hmm. Gave himself more context by learning the rest of it as well.
Yeah, he's wonderful, and he just clicked right in with everybody, and he's the youngest of the crew, mm-hmm. so he shows us a lot of YouTube videos. He's, like, down with pop culture.
Well, it can be tough, you know, being the only out-of-town actor.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, like you said, he's fit right in, clicked right in, and has just worked so hard.
He's hustled. Mm-hmm. He's really great.
It sounds like the story of his casting is a story within itself. She met him in New York, you mm-hmm. say. Was he performing then on a regular basis?
He came to the auditions.
Yeah, he had graduated from Emerson College in 2016, so he's like a very recent college grad. And I know, I actually have seen his both of his parents are actors. I've seen his dad at the Public a few times. He does Shakespeare. So I know he went to school for film. But he has an agent in New York and has been auditioning for voiceovers, auditioning for plays. But I know it's exciting to be like out of college and go out of town to a new city and do such an awesome play. I mean, it's such a role. So he's got tons of people coming in to come see him, which I love. I'm like, who's coming? What week?
Yeah.
The play is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night, the Nighttime. And it runs, well, it's about to start January 26th. It opens up. This is the 22nd. So it's later this week.
Yeah, Friday's our first preview. And our opening night is February 2nd.
Yeah, we'll run through February the 18th. It'll be on campus this time at the Spencer Theater. The number to call, again, for more information, 816-235-2700 or online at kcrep.org. We're speaking with Andy Perkins and Nicole Marie Green, voice 3 and voice 1, respectively. We covered how many characters he plays. I don't know that I did that with you, Nicole.
I do 4 characters. So I play a character named Mrs. Shears. She is the one who gets her dog killed.
Ah.
I know. It's pretty sad, actually. The props department at Kansas City Rep are unbelievable. And they have created this dog that looks real. So everyone know, there's no dogs killed in this production. But they did an incredible job. So yeah, the dog's name is Wellington. And so I play Mrs. Shears, so my dog is killed. I play Mrs. Gascoigne, who is a proper principal. Yeah. Who else do I play? Oh, I play a woman on the train in London.
Yeah, a lot of the character names.
Yeah, it's like woman on train.
Come from Christopher's experience. So one of you have woman on train or shopkeeper.
And shopkeeper.
One of my character's names is man with socks because he has like high tube socks in the subway terminal. So.
It's actually really funny because when people are like, so who are you playing? You're like, well, how much time do you have?
Well, it's quite a discussion, I'm sure.
No, it's great. I mean, there's not a lot of roles that get to do that. But we often talk about primarily who our main character is, and mine is Mrs. Shears, who is a neighbor to Christopher. He calls her a friend. Yeah, but she kind of starts off the whole play running with her dead dog.
Was it ever a radio play? It sounds like it would lend itself to being
one. I don't believe so, but
no,
yeah, with
but
all the different
awesome
characters, I could definitely see that.
Yeah, it could definitely work for that sort of thing. What's really fun, though, is doing the body work, the physical work, because we're, I mean, Andy and I especially are super physical actors. Like, we do a lot of clowning together. We both have training in comedia and mask. Actually, Stephanie Roberts was my mask teacher.
I was going to ask that.
She is the guru. But we're doing a lot of physicality. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a blast. So I think it would aid itself in a radio play. But it's like doubly enhanced that we get to sort of become different things and make sounds. And we did do voiceover work. The voiceovers we recorded we recorded on the second day, which is always risky business because you're like, we don't know what the tempo is going to be, what's going to work. And it's actually worked out great. And then we've also had a movement coach come in from California named Erica. And she came in for 3 days and really intensively worked with us. So we're all in our workout gear.
Really elevated a lot of those movement moments.
Yeah.
There's a moment or a series of moments throughout the play where Christopher is traveling by himself, and it can be very overwhelming to him when he's on the train or on the subway or these announcements are coming over the intercom. And so we represent that through the voiceovers and kind of highlight the specific things and the multitude of specific things that are coming at him all at once.
It's almost like if you are walking through Times Square and watching multiple Super Bowl Sunday commercials all overlapping at the same time.
Yeah. And, like, and noticing everything about all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which would be overwhelming for anyone.
I mean, that gave me anxiety just describing that. So.
Oh, yeah. And that's a problem, I guess, with autism, following all of this and staying calm. How is the character now? How is he able to deal with all these distractions and still look into the murder aspect of the
plot? Yeah, well, there's a character named Siobhan who is his teacher, who has a recurring presence, even when she's not physically there. He kind of has this memory of her that comes in and out throughout the course of the story. And she also plays the role of the narrator as well. reading this story that Christopher has written about his experience. And so she kind of pops in, especially during moments where he is being overwhelmed, and provides coping mechanisms or just reminders of, you know, count the cubes of the cardinal numbers again, or follow your red line.
Yeah,
or
simplify your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, Christopher is an incredible mathematician. Mm-hmm. Like, he's really good at math.
Maths.
Yeah, we call it, in England, they call it maths. But he deals a lot with numbers, and he loves structure. So that was kind of the way he sees everything. When everything is structured, he feels at ease. Mm-hmm. So that inspired a lot of the movement pieces too, where it's wild and curvy and circular, and then when Christopher has control over it, it becomes more angular and square and predictable. So numbers, a lot of times you'll hear him throughout the script kind of just reciting numbers to himself. It calms him down, which sure. is great.
Now, this special interpretive performance, I didn't write down the date, is which date?
February 13th, okay. Which is a Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. They should ask specifically for details on that particular performance.
Correct.
The name of the show, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, opens in previews on Friday, January 26th. It runs then through February the 18th at the Spencer Theater on the campus of UMKC. The number to call, once again, 816-235-2700, or online at kcrep.org. I want to thank my guests for coming and telling us all about this production. Andy Perkins, voice number 3, local actor, does Shakespeare, was in The Diary of Anne Frank, The Coterie as well, and Nicole Marie Green, voice number 1, also in the, I bet that's how they met, Diary of Anne Frank, The Christmas Carol. She was also in Our Town with the unique staging. No time to talk about that now, but we could sometime. Coterie, Unicorn, Shakespeare Festival, and part of the MFA program at UMKC. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having
for being
us.
With us tonight,
appreciate
today.
It
seems like night because it's so dark outside. We're going to take a brief break. When we return, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about Project Dawn. It may be what you think, but we'll see when we return. You're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM. And welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. We're going to go from a serious mystery to, a serious topic, I'll say. But we'll let the ladies fill us in on that. I bet there's some humor in it as well. Okay, yeah. Is that Nedra?
Nedra's here.
Have on in, Nedra. I can't pull up a chair from you, but pull up one of those chairs and pull up to the mic for you. Heidi Van, the director, is with us. She is, I assume, still the curator of the Fish Tank.
I'm the producing artistic director of the Fish Tank, yes.
She's an actress in her own right. She's also a writer, a producer, an artist.
She has all of the things.
I know.
And making my directorial debut at the Unicorn Theater with Project Dawn.
You once did a program where you taught prisoners. I remember reading about that.
I did, yeah. And it really connects to this play that we're doing, too, having that experience working with that population.
Yeah.
As Project Dawn is about a program that was piloted in Philadelphia, a court system that dealt with prostitutes in a therapeutic way to get them back into housing and employment and independence.
I did read that, yes, it is an actual project in Philadelphia.
That's correct.
Yeah. Jennifer Mays is with us as well.
Hello.
Actress. She's worked in many places. Where haven't you worked?
Oh, I don't know.
The Unicorn.
Wherever that is, please hire me. I'm available.
The Unicorn, The Rep, The New Theater,
yes.
The Coterie.
Kansas City has fabulous
K-Cat.
Places to work.
What have I left out?
Oh, I can't even remember, but Kansas City is very, very fortunate. We have some amazing places to work, and I am very fortunate to have worked in a lot of them.
Well, sure. Yeah, and Nedra Dixon is with us as well.
Hi.
Boy. Broadway, yeah, off-Broadway,
yeah.
National tours,
yeah.
Regional theater.
Well.
Well, keep it going.
The Rep.
Yeah.
Spinning Tree Theater, where she played a couple of interesting parts. I remember we talked about
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
Last year, led Billie Holiday.
Billie Holiday. Yeah. The Coterie. Yeah. The Unicorn. I guess I said the Unicorn twice. The White House.
Yes.
How recent was that?
Oh, well, that's been the Ford administration.
But still.
So she takes no responsibility for what's going on.
The Kennedy Center Honors mm-hmm. Program.
Mm-hmm. UB Blake was being honored. The year that we performed, I was doing Bubbling Brown Sugar on Broadway. And there were a lot of his songs that were incorporated in the show. And we were honored to be asked to perform when it was time to celebrate UB Blake and his history in music.
He was on the Johnny Carson show a lot. Mm-hmm. That's where he got a lot of initial exposure, which, of course, only added to his career.
Absolutely.
And all of that. Yeah, quite a gentleman. Carnegie Hall.
Yeah.
You know that old line, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice.
There you go.
And a lot.
And Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
A big room.
You can't imagine. So.
Okay. Well, welcome all of you to the show. The name of, it's at the Unicorn. The name of the show is Project Dawn. And as Heidi talked about, it's about people who work in the adult industry, let's say. Is that a pretty good way of characterizing it?
Well, it's about women who have found themselves in being picked up for prostitution and in the sex trade industry. So how they ended up there was not necessarily their choice, but it's about the women who are the clients of the court, and it's also about the staff members of the court who help them, and about this program called Project Dawn. And that's what I really feel. The play really follows the journey of how this program, what its mission was, and how it strives to serve its clients, and whether it is successful or not.
I'm going to guess that it's names probably changed, but the real incidents.
It's based on the author Karen Hartman went to visited the court many, many times. She sat in on many of them, and she actually had started with kind of a different project in mind, but after watching the court realized, oh, no, this is the story. These women and what they're doing for these women are the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You play several different roles.
We each play two roles. We each play both sides of the fence, if you want to say that. Each one of us is a member of the court, either a lawyer or the judge or a caseworker. And we each play a client, is how they're referred to, a woman who is on the stand, who is working very hard to fix her life. Some of them successfully, some of them not so successfully, but each of us, and on a dime. You'll see the seven actresses on stage turn into the other character, turn right back into the other character with very, very little time, almost no time, and no costume change per se. Mm-hmm. You're just going to know that they are the other. And I think it's a little bit of there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know. Mm-hmm. You kind of look at it that way. Oh, well, if any of us had been put in that situation, it's very possible we could have ended up here as well.
Well, I suppose that is always possible.
Absolutely.
I suppose.
Well, actually, both Jen and I are playing the two lawyers in the show. I'm the prosecuting attorney, and Jen is the defense side of the table. And both of us have had issues with substance abuse in our life, in our lives, in our personal lives. Yeah. So,
both of the, let's clarify, both of the attorneys in
yes.
the play.
Yes, not, yes. Had, also, not Netra and Jen personally, no. Yes. I mean, no. But the characters have had issues, are having issues with substance abuse, and there, it could easily slip into that if they were not treating their recovery time or their choices with great care and hopefully always mindful of them, it can ruin marriages, it can ruin careers, and it's certainly feasible that though we are lawyers, all of that could be stripped away, and our choices very limited to perhaps ending up on the skids, so to speak. So,
well, how is that What is that like for her? Here she is prosecuting this woman, but she also knows in her heart that she has also done things that she could have been prosecuted for.
I would think that probably because the women who started the court, the lawyers who started the project, this is a voluntary thing for them. They're giving their time to the system, to change the system. And I would think that that was their mindset, that I am in a position to hopefully make a drastic change within a system that is crippling these women as well as their own choices. So their issues with abuse have propelled them into being proactive in the system that they work in, that their careers happen to be in, to make a change and make a substantive a great change.
There's a line in the play, I think it says a couple of times, that Project Dawn is all about second chances.
Well, that happens.
And sometimes third and fourth.
Sometimes. Absolutely. As well. Tell me about your character, the attorney and the other ladies.
The attorney and the other. I'm the defense attorney who co-founded Project Dawn, Gwen McGowan. And yeah, these women are volunteering their time. So this is a woman who also has a family and a full-time career, a more than full-time career as a defense attorney and as an educator. And to try to do this out of her back pocket, she says, is a little much. You know, she's hiring interns that she's paying for herself. She's just paying out of her own pocket so that she has somebody to try to help, but it's just not quite enough. So she's a bit overextended, and we kind of watch how Gwen deals with this. The other character is Cassie, a young lady who was a victim, they say, a bad rape, like there's such a thing as a good rape, but a victim of a bad rape that has left her with damaged hip, and this court system is the only chance she has to try to get it fixed. And yet, when you are dealing with crippling pain, how can you treat it when you're an addict? So she's having a lot of trouble getting away from the drugs to try to treat the pain that was a result of being a sex worker, which was probably because of drugs, and it's a vicious cycle, and these women are trying so hard to break the cycle.
Having worked with prisoners, I just find this interesting.
It is interesting. It's interesting to get to know the human behind a statistic or a story or a narrative or a prescribed role that you give someone because they are charged with something or wearing a uniform. So I was attracted to this project and was grateful to receive you know, the invite to direct at the Unicorn Theater. Also, an interesting thing about this play is it is a rolling world premiere. So the National New Play Network selects plays to receive these rolling world premieres. And the Unicorn is the third in a series of theaters that have produced this show. So it started where it was commissioned in Philadelphia by People's Light. People's Light Theater, is that right?
I think so. I think so.
And then it went to the Horizon Theater in Atlanta, and now it is here. So the script has also gone through its own journey. So our job, which is exciting, especially as like a theater practitioner, a theater maker, is that, you know, we're in the process of what this play will ultimately become as well. And our work and our, you know, indulgence in like working through these specific pages that we got, which are different from the other two. Like that's our job right now to for the playwright and for
she's
the
learning
piece.
And growing.
So she's learning through this, you know, grand venture that we're doing, which is producing her play. And so, it's a fun project on many levels because of the connection to social work and social justice and also new play development.
Yeah.
So my mind's just in heaven.
It's a play about these extraordinarily sensitive and real life issues. But on the other hand, it has to be something that is theatrically compelling to an audience to sit and listen to. There, these stories are compelling in and of themselves, how do you find a way to tell them dramatically and artistically to make an audience sit there and listen and hopefully hear and maybe be impacted and changed by it? So it's a, I would think for Miss Hartman, it will be yet another expansion on her horizon as the playwright to continually grow and hone and make it a piece, since theater is the venue that she's chosen to highlight this issue, that it becomes a really wonderful workable piece of art as well as a slice of life.
Yeah. Some, I've had writers, of course, on the show before, novelists, and they always say one of the things they like best is they can take the same subject matter, often of which they know a lot about, mm-hmm. but they can mold it the way they want to. Mm-hmm. They can make it come out the way they want mm-hmm. to, and they can point out certain things that they want to point out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's really why they're attracted to that. And I assume that's probably why she wanted it to be done in the form of a play, mm-hmm. the way she did.
Well, it's always dynamic to see a human being tell a story of a human being, you know? Yeah. And so especially the delicacy and of these circumstances and the humanity, how people are just a decision or a breath away of being in these positions.
Same shoe. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
When you got this assignment, mm-hmm. what was your thoughts as far as how you would like to see this go? I mean, I'm sure you have very talented mm-hmm. people here, so I'm sure you wanted to see it go a certain way, but you knew that they have their ways of interpreting things, and they would be very good. So.
Well, yeah. No, the most exciting thing when you get an assignment is like, yes! You know? And also, it's an all-female cast. At the time that I got it, I was also producing a female-driven show, and so I was excited to get the call and get the offer. And then, since I've been offered this show, I've seen 3 versions of the script. You know, so, like, it's been changing and evolving, and so we knew what we had to do to start hone and focus is get our auditions and get our cast so that they could start working too, because this is a thick script,
yes,
you know, and as much time as they could have to prepare to come into the room, which they did, like where we were able to get based on like how everyone was like off book and like ready to go was incredible. We moved much quicker, and their work clearly, you know, obviously helps my work. When you pick the right people, like, it's awesome. I mean, I talk a lot in rehearsals, like we're playing a sport, like we're playing basketball, or I talk like, you know, I make weird sound effects. But, like, moving this group was easy because they were already in the game. You know, like, they were ready to go, ready to pivot, ready to move. Like, we all were ready and stretched out by the time we got there that we could just jump in and start making decisions. So, yeah.
Well, in Jen's case, what was the hardest part? I guess going from one character to another character almost on the fly.
Well, not for Jen Hayes. She just played 40 characters.
Yeah, last Christmas I did a show at the Unicorn where I played 40 characters. I just wrote to the author of that one, and I said, you know, after that show, it's like training for a marathon and then going for a light jog. It's lovely. Switching back and forth between the characters I love that kind of stuff. It's fun, but it's finding, when you do something like that, finding the extreme differences between the characters and then finding the real differences between the characters and making sure that it's always clear to the audience which one you are when you don't have anything really to show it. But at the same time, each of them is real. That was the difference. The one last year, because there were 40 of them, many of them were caricatures. Mm-hmm. And these women cannot be. They mm-hmm. need to be characters. They need to all be very, very real humans.
Yeah. Now, Nedra, you've played a lot of parts that were more musical in nature, at least the ones I've seen you do.
Yeah.
How was this different?
Well, I've primarily been a musical theater actor, but I was, in my studies, I was a performance major pretty strictly in theater, in not musicals, but theater. So, but that ventured off later when we discovered that I sang as well. So, and that took a whole nother turn. So this isn't It's not a new form for me, but and it's kind of wonderful to come back to solely a character who doesn't have the heightened experience of adding music to or dance to explore and experience the person that I'm portraying or the persons in this case. So it's a lovely, wonderful, warm blanket again to do a play that I don't have to sing in order to be alive on stage.
Well, no, you don't have to sing.
She just sings backstage.
Do you?
No, not enough.
Not yet.
Not enough.
Is that how you relax? Some people tell me that that's how they relax.
Some days.
Yeah, it sounds like a very demanding show, really. It opens at the Unicorn. It runs through from January the 24th. This is the 22nd. So you actually have previews opening in
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And we'll run through February the 18th at the Unicorn Theater. The number to call, 816-531-7529, extension 17. And arrangements can be also be made online at unicorntheater.org. The Unicorn is just down the street from here, 3828 Main. There's two stages at the Unicorn. This is the Levin stage, mm-hmm. I'm going to assume. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
it is.
There's also two Fridays that are featured Fridays, and there's more information online, but one of those I'm sure, I know that the playwright is coming in town, and so you'll be able to meet Karen Hartman, the playwright, and I believe that's February 9th.
Will that include a question?
February 2nd.
Oh, it's February 2nd?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are some talkbacks scheduled. I'm not sure mm-hmm. if there's one
several
scheduled.
Talkbacks.
Yeah, and those should be online, so when you select mm-hmm. the day that you want to go to the show, there's usually an indication whether or not there's a talk back mm-hmm. After the show. And, I always love when theater and community can meet in this sort of forum, because, you know, there are places in Kansas City that strive to do what components of this court does, and I believe we're going to try to include some of those representatives mm-hmm. From those organizations at TalkBack.
Yeah, we've had some interest from several mm-hmm. organizations. Yeah. I'm constantly awed at how many organizations there are like mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. in town that mm-hmm. are helping these women here in Kansas City.
Yeah, and if work can help illuminate those places, just that we all know what resources are in town, then that's like such a beautiful fusion of being a theater artist and being a citizen at the same time, mm-hmm. you know.
if they can be successful at breaking away, what is the best area of employment, for instance, for them to go into? Is any theories on that?
Well, it's difficult. One of the things that the play deals with is the women who complete the Project On program, their records aren't clean, they just don't owe anything else. And if they have a period afterwards where they have not had any legal trouble, then their record will be clean. But you have to live between now and then, yeah. And who hires someone with a record? Mm-hmm. It's who gives a home to someone with a record? Where can these women live and work until their record is clean? And that's difficult. It's difficult.
My character, Shondell, the prostitute character, works at a Comfort Suites mm-hmm. as housekeeper. Lola Barkas works at a
McDonald's. Yeah.
So it's dependent upon, I suppose, mm-hmm. what their backgrounds were prior to mm-hmm. the spiral into the rabbit hole, as to what opportunities might be available to them. But when you've got a record and, mm-hmm. you know, most jobs are do criminal background checks, it can be hard to convince an employer that you're
reformed.
A good candidate. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I would guess, I'm just guessing now, I'm not an expert, a kind of job that would keep them away from a lot of interaction with...
Well, there's other facets and there's other resources, and that's what this play highlights, is that there's housing, there's medical records, there's nutrition, and one thing
emotional
support, some have children, and like one thing that I've always
really wanted to highlight directing the show is Project Dawn, the system. The system. We talk all about this system, and sometimes the system succeeds, and sometimes we are literally holding up the system on the shoulders and it is crushing us. So it's like the way that these ladies, these two attorneys, created this thing, and they created the guidelines of the thing. And sometimes the thing works for some people, and then other times it has failed them. And then what do they do? Mm-hmm. Like, so there, like, there's the tension, and there's the crisis, mm-hmm. and there's the just the meat and potatoes of this play is that, you know, though well-intentioned and, like, all for good, sometimes there is not a one-size-fits-all solution, and people are falling through. And how do we maintain accountability? Mm-hmm. And how do we everywhere, you know...
And how do these women who started this court maintain? Mm-hmm. Because it is a voluntary effort, but it is it can be an all-consuming effort. Mm-hmm. When, you know, in so many ways, not only of time, especially in if you're volunteering your legal expertise, you're also doing something professionally too that mm-hmm. that is not volunteer. So you're mm-hmm. having to prepare for your work life career as well as take time to do this project that you feel passionate about and you want to make a significant change socially. But all of that can have such a turnaround and knock you in the face punch to taking on such an intense and heavy and faceted, multifaceted program to the detriment of those who are trying to do good, even. I mean, not. So it's a very. Mm-hmm. It's like those scales of justice. That
yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a hard thing to keep in mind.
Heavyweight material, to be sure. The show is called Project Dawn. Mm-hmm. It runs through February the 18th, opens January the 24th, I assume in previews.
We preview Wednesday. Which is January 24th.
Mm-hmm. Soon.
We're just running right into that. So,
and don't forget, if you're someone who doesn't think that you can afford a ticket to go see the theater, Unicorn is one of those fabulous places that has Pay What You Can nights. So check out the website, find the Pay What You Can nights, and come see
because
us.
Because the arts are for everyone.
Everyone. Yeah.
3828 Main. The number to call, 816-531-7529, extension 17, and online, unicorntheater.org. I want to thank all of you for coming.
Thank you.
And telling us all about it. Heidi Van, the producing artistic director, did you correct me?
Of the Fish Tank Theater.
As well as an actress and a writer and a producer and all those things. Jennifer Mays, actress, has appeared at most of the theaters in town, and... From what I read, we'll be appearing, I guess, in the spring at the new theater.
In the summer, I'm doing the summer musical, Mamma Mia.
Yeah, she appears there often. She does. And Nedra Dixon, Broadway, off-Broadway. Do you have anything coming up as well, I should ask?
I'm directing for The Spinning Tree. I'm directing Once on This Island.
Yeah. So you work with them a lot, don't you?
They're very good to me.
Thanks so much for being with us. Mark Andrus is here. He's going to be sitting in for the Jazz Insider. But, you know, I bet nothing changes. I'll bet there's going to be some fine jazz from 1 to 3. And then we'll pick up and we'll have the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.